I've never taken a yoga class, though some of my friends have urged me to. And I've never watched YouTube videos to try to learn yoga poses on my own. As much fun as it would probably be to awkwardly attempt to contort my body into very uncomfortable positions on my living room floor, I just don't have any interest in that kind of yoga. But I am interested in yoga as a religious concept and a spiritual practice. And that's what I want to talk about today, using the Bhagavad Gita to try to understand this religious and spiritual sense of yoga. I'm starting with the religious and spiritual sense of yoga because the physical exercise of yoga developed as an aid to the spiritual life. Which makes a great deal of sense to me because I know from experience that physical activities can help us psychologically dispose ourselves to the disciplines of the spiritual life. One thing I should mention here is that I am not an expert on yoga in any sense of the word yoga, or any sense of the word expert for that matter. I'm just going to be conveying my limited understanding of the topic as I try to learn more, and hopefully this will help others to have a better understanding of it as well. If you want to know more about the concepts, literature, and figures mentioned in this podcast, please see the link to my blog where you can find links that will take you to additional information on the concepts, literature, and figures mentioned as I read and comment on a portion of the Bhagavad Gita. And if you want to know which translation I used, that's available on the sources page of my blog. Before I start reading selected portions of the Bhagavad Gita and commenting on them, I want to briefly describe the scene. We are entering onto the field of a great battle between two armies recorded in the great epic of Indian literature, which is known as the Mahabharata. Before the battle is joined, the great warrior Arjuna expresses to Krishna, his charioteer, that he doesn't actually want to kill the other guys. He's sad at the thought that he would be depriving these other great warriors of their lives, and that his life after that point would be burdened by the responsibility for the deaths of these great warriors. Krishna helpfully offers him some perspective in a fairly lengthy speech, and I will read it in several parts while commenting on points of interest to me. Let's start with the first part of his answer to Arjuna's doubts about the rightness of going into battle against his opponents. You speak sincerely, but your sorrow has no cause. The wise grieve neither for the living nor for the dead. There has never been a time when you and I and the kings gathered here have not existed. Nor will there be a time when we will cease to exist. As the same person inhabits the body through childhood, youth, and old age, so too at the time of death he attains another body. The wise are not deluded by these changes. When the senses contact sense objects, a person experiences cold or heat, pleasure or pain. These experiences are fleeting. They come and go. Bear them patiently, Arjuna. Those who are unaffected by these changes, who are the same in pleasure and pain, are truly wise and fit for immortality. Assert your strength and realize this. The impermanent has no reality. Reality lies in the eternal. Those who have seen the boundary between these two have attained the end of all knowledge. Realize that which pervades the universe and is indestructible. No power can affect this unchanging, imperishable reality. The body is mortal, but that which dwells in the body is immortal and immeasurable. Therefore, Arjuna, fight in this battle. Now that we've heard the first part, I want to mention that Krishna is asserting a common belief about how the universe works and how we exist within the universe. Specifically, that we are, at our core, a consciousness which lives beyond death and into an afterlife to be born again into another life and to die again, only to reach yet another afterlife and then another birth, and so on over and over through the ages. Another thing I want to mention is that this can change how we understand the value of life. And Krishna offers us the conclusion that once we understand that we exist eternally, temporal changes like aging and death are of much less concern. Later, we will learn from Krishna what he says is of greater concern. But for now, I'll read the next part of his exhortation to Arjuna. One believes he is the slayer. Another believes he is the slain. Both are ignorant. There is neither slayer nor slain. You were never born. You will never die. You have never changed. You can never change. Unborn, eternal, immutable, immemorial, you do not die when the body dies. Realizing that which is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and unchanging, how can you slay or cause another to slay? As one abandons worn-out clothes and acquires new ones, so when the body is worn out, a new one is acquired by the self, who lives within. The self cannot be pierced by weapons or burned by fire, water, cannot wet it, nor can the wind dry it. The self cannot be pierced or burned, made wet or dry. It is everlasting and infinite, standing on the motionless foundations of eternity. The self is unmanifested, beyond all thought, beyond all change. Knowing this, you should not grieve. O mighty Arjuna, even if you believe the self to be subject to birth and death, you should not grieve. Death is inevitable for the living. Birth is inevitable for the dead. Since these are unavoidable, you should not sorrow. Every creature is unmanifested at first, and then attains manifestation. When its end has come, it once again becomes unmanifested. What is there to lament in this? The glory of the self is beheld by a few, and a few describe it. A few listen, but many without understanding. The self of all beings living within the body is eternal and cannot be harmed. Therefore, do not grieve. Interestingly, Krishna goes on to conclude that not only should Arjuna fight and kill the other warriors, but that he should not even grieve for the loss of their lives once he understands fully how truly eternal we are as persons. This might seem very callous to some people, but it helps to understand the reasoning behind why Krishna would make these statements. I'll read the next part of Krishna's speech now so that we can start trying to understand his reasoning. Considering your dharma, you should not vacillate. For a warrior, nothing is higher than a war against evil. The warrior confronted with such a war should be pleased, Arjuna, for it comes as an open gate to heaven. But if you do not participate in this battle against evil, you will incur sin, violating your dharma and your honor. The story of your dishonor will be repeated endlessly, and for a man of honor, dishonor is worse than death. These brave warriors will think you have withdrawn from battle out of fear, and those who formerly esteemed you will treat you with disrespect. Your enemies will ridicule your strength and say things that should not be said. What could be more painful than this? Death means the attainment of heaven. Victory means the enjoyment of the earth. Therefore, rise up, Arjuna, resolved to fight, having made yourself alike in pain and pleasure, profit and loss, victory and defeat. Engage in this great battle, and you will be freed from sin. Now, one of the interesting things about this part is that Krishna uses two different lines of moral reasoning. In the first line of reasoning, he encourages Arjuna to avoid the pain of dishonor, and emphasizes exactly how profound that pain will be, while also emphasizing the heavenly and earthly pleasures that result from going into battle. In the second line of reasoning, he encourages Arjuna to abandon his attachment to pleasure and pain, doing his moral duty regardless of the consequences. That may seem contradictory, but given what I know of human moral development, it makes sense to appeal to both our instinctive aversion to pain and also to our desire for a higher moral purpose. We human beings don't just lose our aversion to pain or addiction to pleasure in an instant, and then never deal with that problem in our lives ever again. We gradually reduce our reliance on temporary pleasures and increase our willingness to put up with pain for a higher moral purpose. It's a developmental path rather than an instant of enlightenment. And so we need moral persuasion that reaches us on both levels. And the moral persuasion Krishna is articulating here is based on who Arjuna is, rather than the consequences of his decisions. For Krishna, the moral duty of a warrior flows from his being a warrior. If we are born into the warrior caste, we should live a warrior's life and die a warrior's death, for example. This would also apply for the baker, or the fisherman, or the gravedigger. On his view, our moral duty isn't to avoid suffering, but to be true to who we are. But Krishna is aware that that is not the only way to understand our moral duty. And so I'll read the next part of his statement to Arjuna. You have heard the intellectual explanation of Sankhya, Arjuna. Now listen to the principles of yoga. By practicing these, you can break through the bonds of karma. On this path, effort never goes to waste, and there is no failure. Even a little effort towards spiritual awareness will protect you from the greatest fear. Those who follow this path, resolving deep within themselves to seek me alone, attain singleness of purpose. For those who lack resolution, the decisions of life are many-branched and endless. There are ignorant people who speak flowery words and take delight in the letter of the law, saying that there is nothing else. Their hearts are full of selfish desires, Arjuna. Their idea of heaven is their own enjoyment, and the aim of all their activities is pleasure and power. The fruit of their actions is continual rebirth. Those whose minds are swept away by the pursuit of pleasure and power are incapable of following the supreme goal and will not attain samadhi. Krishna lets it slip here that he alone is the one we should follow, subtly revealing that he is the avatar of Vishnu, the preserver and sustainer of the universe who pervades all things. He exhorts us to a single-minded focus on this purpose, and to not be distracted by seeking pleasure and power. He tells us that focusing wholly on this transcendent purpose will free us from the decision paralysis we experience when we are confronted with the many choices of life. But what does that have to do with yoga? To help us understand how this begins to connect back to yoga, I will read from the next portion of Krishna's statements to Arjuna. The scriptures describe the three gunas, but you should be free from the action of the gunas, established in eternal truth, self-controlled, without any sense of duality or the desire to acquire and hoard. Just as the reservoir is of little use when the whole countryside is flooded, scriptures are of little use to the illumined man who sees the Lord everywhere. You have the right to work, but never to the fruit of work. You should never engage in action for the sake of reward, nor should you long for inaction. Perform work in this world, Arjuna, as a man established within himself, without selfish attachments, and alike in success and defeat. For yoga is perfect evenness of mind. Now we have learned that the yoga of which Krishna speaks entails a calm and peaceful mind. Krishna reiterates his call to look beyond the consequences of our actions and do the work that is true to who we are in life. This is something I really struggle with personally. I'm very task-oriented, and I have an investment in accomplishing the goal of my work each day. But life often gets in the way of reaching our goals, and it's valuable to be reminded that what is more important is doing good work, whether it has the outcomes we would prefer or not. So, what is the outcome of the disciplined practice of yoga? I'll read the last part of this discourse in order to find out what Krishna advises us to strive for. Seek refuge in the attitude of detachment, and you will amass the wealth of spiritual awareness. Those who are motivated only by a desire for the fruits of action are miserable, for they are constantly anxious about the results of what they do. When consciousness is unified, however, all vain anxiety is left behind. There is no cause for worry whether things go well or ill. Therefore, devote yourself to the disciplines of yoga, for yoga is skill in action. The wise unify their consciousness and abandon attachment to the fruits of action, which binds a person to continual rebirth. Thus, they attain a state beyond all evil. When your mind has overcome the confusion of duality, you will attain the state of holy indifference to things you hear and things you have heard. When you are unmoved by the confusion of ideas and your mind is completely united in deep samadhi, you will attain the state of perfect yoga. One of the very interesting points in this last part of Krishna's response is that he asserts that yoga is both a set of practices and a state of being. Like our path of moral development, yoga is a path of spiritual development on which we need to know how to walk 1 mile and also need to know what our destination looks like. The yoga of Krishna is both the end and the way of the spiritual life, a single-minded focus on union with the divine, which pervades all things, that leads us beyond all evil, and in the process, brings us the peace we need to be true to ourselves rather than being attached to having material resources or accomplishing great things. The irony for me is that Krishna teaches us that in abandoning our need to accomplish great things in this life, we can then accomplish a much greater thing that pulls us out of even our primal need to avoid suffering in this life. Well, this is the end of my comments on this particular portion of the Gita, and I hope you enjoyed it. And please let me know if there's anything more that you want me to talk about in this, or if you want more links to research, I would be happy to provide those kinds of things. And I hope you all have a wonderful evening, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.